Right, in fact, it has been established. The point is, he simply mislabeled the wall, the stones they found. He would not have done it if he had paid attention to the progress made by the British already, but the Germans had done it. It's going to look the British to make which is they make big mistakes.
You say the wall they found was earlier or later?
Earlier. Joshua's law has never been found. I said it, but he found several books that say it's been established by Captain Kenyon mainly, who died this past year, by the way, that that wall was too early. It was a middle bronze or a wall, not a late bronze wall. And yet, you still find books out that say it's something like Joshua's wall, but they just haven't updated their scholarship.
What was that, Jericho?
Old Testament Jericho. The Americans, a scholar named Reisner of Harvard, led out in a very fine project at Samaria, right here, and this was the first. This was in 1908. And by the way, selling and watching was not 1908. It was about 1901. Selling and watching. This was one of the first fully financed excavations. Jacob Schiff. I heard of Jacob Schiff. These early millionaires. He was getting rich at the same time as Jay Gould and John D. Rockefeller and a few others. The great capitalist barons of America. Well, Schiff had a lot of money. And that was the period when you were supposed to buy your culture if you didn't have it. You bought your culture, you read it or not. And you hired people to find great works of art if they were good. Well, one of the things he did was he invested in archaeology. It was very, very fine. But Jacob Schiff financed Reisner and worked in Samaria. However, and again, there was a significant advance in technique. In the 1920s, there was going to be progress, continued progress was made. And I'm just catching this because there can't be anything else in critical time. 1920s, these were the Helician years, the great years of Palestine archaeology, the period between the wars. There were two great scholars who became the teachers of all of archaeology in Palestine. One was a French Dominican priest named Vincent. The other was an American scholar, William Foxwell Albright. These two dominated Palestinian archaeology in the 20s and early 30s. Vincent, this French Dominican priest, and William Foxwell Albright. And they really began to the techniques were refined. Friend, they would go and set up a grid work. You know, not only keep records, but they would impose a grid upon an area. And they would label, they would photograph everything that they found. And they would label it so that you would know where it came as far as the depth and where it came as far as in relation horizontally. You understand that? You keep complete records. And very fine work was done. The 1930s, the most famous figure was a student of William Foxwell Albright, Nelson Glick. Doing my work for my master's, I studied in the private library of Nelson Glick while he was still alive, before he died tremendously. But Nelson Glick was famous because he was raised in the German school. The Germans were teaching that the Bible was totally unreliable, and so if they're still in the process of locating many sites, and the German attitude was, if the Bible says it's there, don't bother to look. And the Germans dominated theological, religious, even archaeological school. Albright was trained in the Germans, so he learned to train with the Germans, the German methodology, learned better. And Albright was probably the greatest of them all. Albright discovered that the Bible is historically reliable, in most cases at least, there to be checked. And he said that what we were taught in Tuning was wrong. The first place you ought to know, the Germans said the Bible is totally mythology of the Old Testament. Don't worry about it. It says, you don't bother to look. The Bible locates the city or community somewhere. And Albright taught his students under Nelson Glick and G. Ernest Wright and some others, Richard. He taught them that if the Bible says it's there, you'll look there first. And so Glick's great contribution was he simply surveyed, more survey work, using the Bible as his guide, located many important sites centered by on the scriptures. And famous for this, he was not a believer, not a Christian. He did not believe the Bible was the Word of God. He simply believed the Bible was historically accurate in most cases, but in the case was to be checked. So using the Bible as his guide, Glick made his famous surveys of mostly the southern areas that had not been surveyed before, and located many, many important biblical sites. A great step forward in Palestinian archaeology. Let's bring this to the 50s talk about tomorrow, Kathleen Kenyon, and it's very important to you, that died last year. So, we'll begin with that tomorrow. Glick, 1930s and on. One more point, quiz tomorrow. Over the emperors, the Herodian succession, and the Messianic Pope. It'll be a short quiz, or I'll give it to you. All archaeology discovered in ancient Palestine. We must mention the late Dame Catherine Kenyon, who died in the state this past year. She was the leading archaeologist in the last decade in Palestine. And she worked at Jericho, at the Old Testament Jericho, and she worked in Jerusalem. She was working in Jerusalem when she died. Now, she was responsible for it. And I have been pointing out that there was a gradual development beginning with Sir Flinders Petrie, who established the basic thing of keeping records and dating by pottery and establishing relative date. The most important refinement of this method was worked out by this woman archaeologist, Kathleen Kenyon, and in conjunction with another scholar named Wheeler, is known as the Kenyon-Wheeler method, and I'll explain it very briefly for your interest. What she pointed out was that you go into a site and you excavate it, you take off this layer, you make a record of this layer, and you remove it, it's gone forever. And then you go down to the next layer and move it, and it's gone. She pointed out that sometimes you get into what I call anachronism, things that are out of sequence for a number of reasons. The most important thing that caused confusion in anachronisms is that often, especially in the walls around the city, instead of the city, this is the city wall, that they when a city was besieged or was remodeled, for any number of reasons, they would often reuse the stones in a different place. Well, and sometimes these stones were set 2 or 3 or 4 feet into the ground. They would set stones, they would dig trenches for the foundations of these walls for the simple reason that you had to do so, or people would simply dig under them in time of siege. Well, when they would, so here's it, this is the ground level, and they would dig a large trench for a wall, or a deep trench. And then put a stone in here, in this city. Well, if they reuse the stone, often materials, pottery, or any datable materials, will end up in the hole. You know. They end up down the bottom of this hole. Actually, it fell in from up here. Or sometimes they would simply use them as dumps, you know, or they would plug it. What do you do if you're a construction site? You're tearing out something, you get a hole. Well, you'll throw the old. You throw the broken bricks in the hole, or the sawed off pieces of block, anything you don't want. You use for filler. Throw it in the hole. Well, the problem is that when the archaeologist comes along, often they would find in the sequence, it would be like this, and they would find materials here that predated these materials. But when they end up digging, they would be out of sequence. They would be. I mean, the materials that would actually belong in the strata above this material, therefore being later, would be alongside or even beneath it, because they were putting, following, they would dig down through the strata in the hole. These materials that are in the hole,
And it was very confusing. If you just dig across, all of a sudden you find something way down, you know, in the strata. You find something down here that really belongs up here. You understand what I'm saying?
Because it was a good hole dug for the wall.
So she, and it was very, and it often confused archaeologists. So she devised a method to solve this and other problems, which I don't have time to go into. And she devised a very simple method. She said, you go in to an excavated site. And what she did, she had this refinement of the basic, you know, grid work and recording system set up by Petrie and refined by such men as Reisner and McKenzie and others. She said, let's do this. Before we take off anything, once you remove it, it's very hard to reconstruct it, mentally even. Before we do anything, she said, let's go in and dig a series of trenches perpendicular to the wall. We're going to dig a series of trenches perpendicular to the wall that is cutting across this or to where the walls used to be. And on the basis of the majority of the material found, establish the chronology of the site before you remove anything. You got that? Take a trench. We just destroyed a very small portion of it. And material that comes from the walls, you would set them aside and date them later, realizing they're probably out of sequence, so they're not reliable. So that by this way, they were not fooled by materials that were in foundation holes. In other words, if they dug a long trench across a large section, then this would give them enough material to know which belongs to what, which type of pottery, for instance, belongs to which strata, without being confused by these exceptions, such as walls that have been removed. You understand that? So, and then that is established, they established the chronology, not as they went along, as they had done earlier, which is very confusing sometimes when they come to something out of sequence for this reason or other reason. But establish the chronology first by these trenches, and once you've done that, then you begin to remove the layers. Very effective method, so that when you found something out of sequence, you had enough other material you'd gotten from your trenches to know that this was out of sequence. And say it made the work much more precise. And well, anyway, is that interesting to you? That's kind of give you some inside feel for archaeology. Very important task, yes.
So right, you still need the wall from the years now. How did the archaeologists know that the wall was there?
Well, they often they wouldn't, until they got enough of the site to develop that they saw what was going on. They wouldn't have any way of knowing it.
They don't want to know that you go across the region of the
Because, like I said, two trenches or three trenches, you see, they would find material work belongs, all of a sudden they'd find this anachronism here, as they found it here and here. They would recognize, well, this, you know, in this line, you've got material out of sequence. You know, well, they don't belong too far down. Therefore, this is a wall. So there would be an ancient wall there. The stones are new. Therefore, they would not be fooled by this. They would go by what they found in the rest of the trenches, in their other areas, to establish their chronology in place. Yes?
How did you spell her,
I think? K-E-Y-N-Y-O-N.
You've written several books. Where all cities of the Old Testament are in the Plains
still? I'm still understanding that. What?
Okay, this is like you're looking at a wall from a helicopter.
Oh, okay.
Okay, I'm sorry. This is a city wall. Where the wall had been, which had been removed. So by digging across the site, digging the trenches from various angles, perpendicular, you know, then they could establish the chronology before they got fooled by the exceptions. It's called the Kenyon Wheeler method. It's very important because it made the art of dating so much more precise. Yes.
Can you count average depth one?
No, it depends on how long it's been occupied. And for one of the things that the you see, one of the problems is, by the way, one more point, a further refinement of this, as more sites begin to be developed in Palestine, then they begin to make the other thing that made dating more precise was that they were able to cross-check, say, the ceramic index, that is, the kind of pottery was found at a certain level, with other places. I mean, where this helped is that in some sites, let's say you had this mound
over here represents the city, Shechem, and this mountain over here represents Gezer. And you know what? And if you at the beginning enough of these, you know a certain kind of pottery exists in a certain place. One of the problems is that sometimes these cities were not continuously occupied. Maybe this city was occupied for 2 centuries, and then for some reason, for 1,000 years or 800 years, it was not occupied. Then it was occupied again. Well, the problem is that this level represents the new occupation. This level represents the former occupation. But there's a gap of 800 years in between. You really fool you if you're digging. So what you do is, you would go to another mound where during this gap, this was occupied. And by comparing the pottery, say, from this level to this level, and this level, say, to this level, then they would know, they would say, well, this pottery corresponds to this, and this pottery and other materials correspond to this, therefore we know there was a gap here. I'm not being fooled by it. For instance, this, remember I said that the German Selin misdated the wall he found at Jericho? One of the reasons was he just assumed that Jericho had always been occupied. He just counted down levels. Well, it hadn't been. Now, if it lay not occupied for a century or two, it messes up this. So they have to compare with some other site. You'll see that? So then this helped as the expansion. Yes.
Did you say that the liberals still use that type of dating?
No. The Germans have come around now finally after the field of archaeology. They have to use methods discovered by non-Germans.
Like the old
writings. They have to.
Like the old writings, like Rabbi Kelly's country, they dance their things like that.
Well, the question's not a good question. It's a good question. I mean, it doesn't have a good answer because the Germans had never done much in the field of archaeology because they had their theories all worked out. And right away they saw that what the archaeologists found messed up their theories, so I just never were very interested in archaeology. Like when Schliemann, found Troy, the Germans already decided that Troy didn't exist. He said, I did, I found it. And they said, no, you didn't. They said, he said, come and look. And they said, we don't have to look, it's not there. They didn't have a look. They said, well, where'd I get this? He had ancient Trojan helmets and jewelry, and where'd I get this? He said, well, you manufactured it. You know, it doesn't exist. Interesting. That's the same attitude, you know. That's what those are, the elements. Anyway. So they really didn't deal with it. No, they didn't. So they didn't write, they just didn't ignore them. By the way, still today, there's the German school of archaeology versus the American, Israeli, British school of archaeology. The last two are the same one. The American, British, Israeli school of archaeology. We're at war with the German school of archaeology. And the basic difference is that the American, Israeli, British school of archaeology, because of the influence of such men like Vincent, the Dominican priest, and William Foster Albright, and Nelson Gregg, and G. Ernest Wright, and Kenyon, because of their work, they insist on changing the theories to fit the evidence. The Germans also insist on changing the evidence to fit the theory. I would find a piece of evidence that obviously says something. And if it doesn't fit the German theory, it's not made in Tübingen. And they don't like the evidence, so they just reject it. So they're warning each other. Yes.
How far back in archaeology?
Well, not in Palestine. Palestine, the oldest culture exists. It's called an Artukian culture, and Mount Carmel, and it goes back to about 4,000 to 5,000 BC. And other places, in the ancient Near East and Anatolia, the earliest civilization dates back to as continuous civilization. It goes back to roughly 10,000 BC. Which is my own mind. I date the flood between 10 and 14,000 BC. This is the earliest, reliably dated, continuous, and maybe a little bit long, maybe 8,000 BC, can't be sure, but even 8,000 to 10,000 BC is the oldest continuous occupation of the site. It has not been interrupted by the flood.
Beyond that, it's all chaos. But not in Palestine, by the way. Okay, good question. Now, I know archaeology is interesting to some people, some people isn't. I just wanted to get some feel for the discovery of ancient Palestine. What are some of the things that we know on the base? Now, by the way, Palestine, especially Jerusalem, has not been a site which has been very productive or rewarding as to the archaeologists. Jerusalem has been especially disappointing because Jerusalem is one of those cities that has been subjected to so much destruction that it's not a good site to dig, because they would often, so much has been destroyed so many times, that Jerusalem has not been very rewarding. That's comparative now. That's not an interesting thing, but it's been very frustrating to dig in Jerusalem. Other places have turned up more information. Let me talk about some of these things about just in brief, and I'm going to talk about some of these things a little bit later on, but some I want to talk about right now. First of all, we talk about, for instance, if you go to the Holy Land today, you go to the traditional birthplace of Jesus, where do you go? What kind of place do you see if you go to see where Jesus was born? The cave. Now, was this the cave that where Jesus was born? Was he born in the cave? The answer is that probably yes. And is this the cave that you're shown the right one? The answer is chances are it is. But you can't be sure. Why? Well, because the tradition that Jesus was born in a cave is a very early tradition. It goes back to Justin Martyr, roughly AD 100. Very early. An early tradition that Jesus was born in a cave. And it's widely accepted. Seems to be. As when Justin Martyr said, Jesus was born in a cave, nobody seems to have objected. That's an argument from silence on the other side, but that's in other words, was he or not, we don't know, but it's a very early tradition that he was born in the cave. And then Jerome, 83-85 roughly, when he wrote, roughly thereabouts, he lived in a cave which was adjacent to the traditional cave where Jesus was born. Now, that's another 285 years, a long time. So whether Jerome, by that time, still knew where the cave was, is problematic. So is it the cave where Jesus was born? The answer, in my opinion, is it could be. Now, by the way, what you get from some of those guys when you go there is sometimes it's tourist stuff. Sometimes it's good, sound scholarship. Very often it's outdated scholarship. But something in the field. The Roman Catholics are very sure this is the spot where Jesus was born. But was he born in a cave? The answer is very possible. Even probable. Was it the cave you see when you go over there? The answer is it's possible. That's about as far as you can go.
Was there a fire in the
form? No. Mm-hmm. We know that Hadrian, the emperor, after the first and early second century, desecrated the cave. And Constantine built a church. Constantine's mother built a church over it in the 4th century. And if you go there today to the cave, you can see floor mosaics, you know, inlaid tile pictures on the floor. And they are from this basilica which Constantine's mother built. So the cave that you go to today is the one that Constantine's mother identified. But Constantine's mother was a tourist. And she was going pretty much on what Jerome said. So the question is, when Jerome identified a cave, the question was it the right one? Well, it is 385 AD, so you just take your choice. It could be. You can't be sure of it.
What was the emperor's name?
Hadrian.
Hadrian?
Hadrian. Okay. Yes.
Did Jerome live in the cave right next to
him? Yes. For part of his life, lived in the cave next to near, adjacent to the cave where he said Jesus was born.
Was he a hermit or something?
No. People lived in caves a lot back then. Good question there. Temperature was right. Constantly year round.
And, mosaics on the floor there came from the basilica. The remains of the basilica was consecrated by the veil. Early in the 4th century, that's early 300. Jerome did the same care as contemporary. He identified it. The question is, was Jerome right? And we don't know. There's a real possibility. But it's just that the cave you see is actually cave you see the one. Now you can't be sure. You can't be sure he was born in a cave. Justin Martin had been wrong. We know from the writings that was a very early tradition. That if there were some who would, that was 8100 in the early tradition. So, pay your money, take your choice. Yes.
Are you watching in that area?
Yes. Jacob's Well, we're sure about the Pool of Siloam and Bethsaida,
You can be sure about Jericho. An excavator named Kelso has excavated New Testament Jericho. By the way, you know, don't you, that Old Testament Jericho is not on the same side as New Testament Jericho. The old side has been abandoned. And New Testament Jericho, where Zacchaeus climbed the sycamore tree for the Lord he wanted to see, has been excavated in part, revealing the splendor of his glorious city, the beautiful city. Herod, as we pointed out, had beautified it, drowned one of his sons, or had one of his sons drowned there. And so you can be sure there that you're walking solidly where Jesus walked, and, you know, on the same street that he has been down. And you're a very beautiful city. And what Zacchaeus was, he was probably not a tax collector in the accepted sense. He was probably a toll collector. Kind of like a tariff. That's what Jericho was used for, to do a trade from the east into Jericho and collect toll or tariff. That's probably what he was. By the way, another place where you can be sure, you can't walk on this, I don't believe, but you can see it, is the Ecce Homo Arch. Behold, the Ecce Homo is Latin for the behold a man. The pilot said, behold a man. And there are flagstones with a game carved on it, a game of knuckle bones. And in John 19:13, this is called the place of the pavement, Gabbatha, pavement. And there, very likely, if you can look at the exact place of the stone from which Jesus stood during at least some period during his series of five trials or six trials, I don't know how you count. There's nothing very exciting to actually see the stone from which Jesus stood. Now, that's in the Ecce Homo Arch. I'll tell you, obviously, if you can walk, you can see them. But this is run by the Sisters of Zion. And you take it from that. I'm kind of preparing you for your senior trip. You can think about some of these things. I like to do some teaching on before you go so you know that when you're getting the straight stuff or just a lot of touristy travel on.
You didn't even walk that extra one whatever down.
Oh.
What am I?
I can't move your head?
Yeah.
Oh. I thought that was. No. okay. As far as Pilate is concerned, that's about the important things I want to talk about. Let me review quickly. Things you cannot be sure about. Cannot be sure about the place where Jesus was born. Remember, you can be sure about. You cannot be sure about the synagogue in Capernaum, the hospital. You can be sure about the too cool, the Siloam and Bethesda in Jerusalem. You can be sure about the pavement, probably sure, reasonably sure, on which Jesus stood, probably Pilate. You can be sure about Jericho, and of course others like the road from Jerusalem to Jericho, where it's not used to know he's actually walking Jesus' walk.
What about the
some of them classic traditionally, but there's no grounds for knowing or believing that the idea of the life. Now, I differ with, when I get to the crucifixion, I'm going to get to that. I'll just tell you right now that I differ with others who think they're more sure than I am about the site for crucifixion and burial of Jesus. And I'll tell you why, because they don't mind, isn't that correct? I am almost, I'm convinced in my own mind that there's no chance in the world that Gordon's Calvary is the place where Jesus was crucified. I'll tell you why. Other distribution, I almost don't. Any questions on this?
Yes. A little bit different, but I was reading that paper on that cloth. How is it allowed with man? Do you think it has?
I really don't know. I wish I knew the answer to your question. It seems very convincing. I think it's a little early for us to still be investigated. I just thought you ought to read it for your own knowledge at this point. I think it's the evidence of the jury is still out. It's still test to be run and results to be. But I think it's very interesting. Is it possible that it could survive? The answer is yes. One of our problems is, you see, there was so. There's such a vacuum, it's such a historical vacuum in the Middle Ages. But so much went on, we had no way of retrieving, we had no way of knowing or reconstructing that Well, you all read that. I said that article because I think that all the articles have been published. That's the most accurate and up to date. And this, but I really don't know. I think we ought to reserve judgment. I think we ought not to make a mistake and maybe people make what they are, you know, publish the results before the evidence comes in. That's a good way to have egg on your face. And I think before we pile up our own candles, we ought to make sure we're on top of that. So my own mind, Tom, I just suspend judgment. I just have a phone. It doesn't change it, man. It doesn't.
I bet it did. I just wonder if they had any more deaths that are.
They should be running about now, but I haven't heard anything, so I'm just going to wait.
Yeah,
just consider a lot of good money. Just read it and make up your own mind. Well, I reckon just wait and see. I mean, never know for sure. One more word before we move on to move out of the section of the scurvy mansion of Kaufman, talk about the trial of Jesus and calling him the cross next. Now, by the way, I'm not doing these theologically or biblically, I'm doing it historically. What information is it, what life is the historian cast upon it? Well, I just said about this. Let me simply, and I covered this, I think, in the evidence class, or we'll cover it, let me just mention here briefly, that the fact that, for instance, say the Joshua's walls have not been found, the walls of King Solomon's ground, does not mean anything, really. Because what you need to know is that, to sort of get this thing in perspective, is that even though the Bible has enjoyed marvelous vindication and illumination from archaeology, both Old and New Testament, Old Testament, both New Testament, maybe a couple of testament covers a longer period of time. But to get this in perspective, understand that of all the things that could have survived, you know, materials, coins, buildings, scrolls for writing, whatever, of all that could have survived, just a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction, of course, has survived. And you couldn't assign a fraction to it.
Not feed that dog.
You could not say, but you understand that a tiny fraction has survived. Of that tiny fraction that survived, listen to me. Got this? For the tiny fraction of art of man-made material that survived, only a tiny, tiny fraction of that tiny fraction has been located and surveyed. Follow me? Somebody said this is Shechem, or this is Ur. Well, a tiny fraction, that tiny fraction has been surveyed. Remember, I said that even the 30s and 40s, Nelson Glick was making a major contribution simply by locating sites. Follow me? Not excavating them, just locating them, saying this is where it was. Walking out, you know, you didn't have an airplane, most of it. And so the tiny fraction that survived, the tiny fraction of that tiny fraction has been even located and surveyed. Much of it is never there, nobody has had the time for a number of reasons. And somebody looked at, you know, located it. Of the tiny fraction of sites that have been located and surveyed, that is, identified, a tiny fraction of that tiny fraction has there been any excavation done whatever on the site? For instance, there are over 20,000 sites in Iran and Iraq which have been located, but where not one shovel full of dirt has been turned. There were 5,000 known sites in Palestine. Got that? Over 5,000 known sites that would be worthy of excavation in Palestine that never known the shovel. And of the tiny fraction where any excavation has been done, only a tiny fraction of those sites have been excavated. You never excavate a whole site. We learned that from Schliemann. They dug up the whole of ancient Troy. What they did first place, some of those sites are 10 acres. And it takes hundreds of thousands of man hours and hundreds of thousands of dollars to excavate an area the size of this room. Got that? Unspeakable labor. We got a camel hair's brush, you know, and moved dirt with that. And the money was terrific. So I was sites to them where anything has been done. Just a tiny bit of that, of those sites, tiny fraction of those. For instance, Jericho, the walls of Jericho, Joshua's walls may be there, just haven't been a very small portion of the site has been done. Okay? Another tiny fraction that has been excavated of these sites, most of that's not published yet. That is, a tiny fraction of what has been found has been categorically evaluated, cataloged, and published. You know that there are over 500,000 500,000 important cuneiform tablets sitting in museums that nobody has had time to read yet. The greatest field for ancient Near Eastern archaeology today is the basement of the British Museum in London. So few people who can read that material and publish it. And even now, it's very common. For instance, Gerard the Redmond excavated ancient Mycenaeans. He coined the word of the Minoans. This is between the 1500s and 1200, between 2600 and 1400 BC. You know how long it was from the time he found that stuff until he published it? He found it in the early 1935, published in 1952. So that what has been found, very little has been, you follow me, systematically categorized, cataloged, and published. So what? So when the amazing about the marvelous vindication of what has been found from the scriptures, and illumination, which is more important than vindication. Well, what we're looking at is a tiny fraction of a tiny fraction of a tiny fraction of a tiny fraction of a tiny fraction. You got that? So a little bit has been located. That tiny fraction has been, anything has been, a tiny fraction has been dug for these sites. One of the reasons, by the way, they don't dig up all of the site now, is that they recognize the fact it's very likely that future generations will refine archaeological technique even more. And when archaeological technique is refined, they want to leave large, undisturbed areas for them to work on. Very interesting isn't it, for the future. So they say, there's going to come a little bit after us. We're going to be better at it than we are. They'll learn from us. Therefore, see, once you excavate a site, it's destroyed forever. Or the part that you excavate is destroyed forever. As far as finding it, it's in situ, as it originally was. So they never excavate all the sites. But that's not the main reason they don't. The main reason they don't is they have the money.
There's a shortage of archaeologists
there? Oh, yeah. There's so few people.
What's the job opportunity? Oh, man. There's a lot of people willing to.
I recommend this, by the way. I've got connections. If some of you want to work on archaeological digs sometime just as a laborer, you know, to move dirt and sift, I can get you in one probably. You don't make anything. Maybe room and board once you get there. I'll tell you what. I have connections with people who are great. Surprising historic interest. reason that it's so interesting is because the trial of Jesus is the basis of